Thanks so much. And before I get started, I'd like to join everyone else in thanking the organizers for putting together this wonderful workshop and inviting me to speak. It's always a pleasure for me to visit Perimeter, so thanks for having me. So today I'll be telling you about some work constructing some boundary conditions and duality interfaces in 3D n equals 2 quantum field theories, and then some fun things that you can do with these objects once you have them in your hand. So the work today will be based on some work that appeared a few years ago with Demofte and Gaiotto, which I'll briefly review. And then I'll move on to some applications that appeared in some recent work with Tudor Demofte, as well as some work in progress, hopefully, if I have time. So let's jump right into it. Now, this slide is, of course, a little bit redundant for the participants of this workshop. We all have a lot of motivations in mind for studying defects in quantum field theory. That's why we're all here. As we've seen through many of the wonderful talks in the workshop already, we can get a huge amount of mileage from studying defects, for example, in their role as order parameters, their role in organizing dualities. We can, of course, ask if given interesting dualities of quantum field theory, how might the duality be enriched in the presence of additional defect operators? And in the case of quantum field theories with supersymmetry, and perhaps considering twists of these supersymmetric theories, as we'll do today, you can often get interesting topological quantum field theories of cohomological or Witten type that can give you a lot of really rich mathematical structure, and also give you a very precise handle on how to access some of the physics of the twisted theories in the presence of defects. And in addition to having tons of interesting physics supported on these defects, we can, of course, go deeper, as has been alluded to already in the workshop, and consider things like junctions of defects and corners and even richer structures. So the story is a beautiful one, and we have a lot of motivation to pursue these kinds of questions. And so the plan for today will be to first briefly remind you of the construction of some boundary conditions in 3D n equals 2 quantum field theories. And I'll be focusing on boundary conditions that are essentially as symmetric as possible in this context. Many of you might have heard me speak about this work last year at String, so I'll try to be brief and just review it as quickly as I can and set the stage for the applications to follow. Though, of course, if you have questions, you know, please feel free to talk to me or after the talk. So once I review this material, then I'd like to move on to a couple more recent pieces of work, which I think are quite fun. And so I'd like to talk about two different applications when you have boundary conditions in these supersymmetric quantum field theories and duality interfaces, which I'll tell you about in a moment. So the two applications, one has a more mathematical bent, the other has a bit more of a physical bent. On the math side, it'll turn out that we can start saying some interesting things about four-dimensional manifolds and their associated algebraic structures. And of course, the idea that four manifolds and algebraic structures are related to each other has a long history, and I'll explain why having dual boundary conditions and interfaces can give us a new handle on this question. And that's based on some work that appeared earlier this year with Tudor Demofte. And then hopefully I'll also get to application number two, which is has more of a physics-y flavor, which is given a construction of boundary conditions, in particular dual boundary conditions and dual theories, can you derive what can you learn from two-dimensional dualities by studying 3D theories compactified on intervals between left and right boundary conditions and various dual configurations of such objects? So that's where I'll be going today. So let me start by talking about boundary conditions and the notion of dual boundary conditions that I'll need for the rest of the talk. So the setup today, again, is a three-dimensional quantum field theory with n equals 2 supersymmetry. And 3D n equals 2 quantum field theories, as all of us here know, enjoy a rich array of infrared dualities. So I'll say that two theories, I don't have a laser pointer. So I'll say that two theories, T and T check, are dual to one another in an infrared sense if they flow to a common infrared theory, TIR, which in three dimensions will commonly be some interesting superconformal fixed point. And so I'd like to ask, given two dual theories, T and T check, can we identify two boundary conditions that are dual in the same sense? Meaning, can we construct boundary conditions B in theory T and B check in theory T check that are dual in the sense that they flow to a common boundary condition in the infrared? And today I'll focus on boundary conditions that preserve as much supersymmetry as possible, so they'll be half BPS. And again, the hope is that we'll set things up so that ideally these boundary conditions will flow in the infrared to superconformal boundary conditions as well. So we'll ask that they preserve conformal symmetry in the plane of the boundary. Now, in addition to studying boundary conditions that are dual, it's also very fruitful to concomitantly consider another codimension one operator, or a defect, called the duality interface. And a duality interface, again, using in the sense of infrared dualities, is defined today such that it's a codimension one defect between our two dual theories, T and T check, which is defined to flow to the trivial interface in the infrared. So when these two theories coincide, we have no sort of interesting transformation between the two of them. And the reason it's nice to study this in tandem with dual boundary conditions is that you can hope to define a collision process between the duality interface and a boundary condition in one theory to produce a dual boundary condition in the dual theory. So if you can construct a large class of boundary conditions and you have a duality interface in hand, you can really construct a host of these dual pairs in a very nice way. And as we saw yesterday in the workshop, there's often some interesting mathematical structure behind collisions and products of these interfaces, at least in favorable conditions, say with supersymmetry and with a twist that enables the collision to be studied a little bit more precisely. So again, the setup today that we considered with Dimofte and Gyoto is to study a half BPS boundary condition in a 3D n equals 2 quantum field theory just on a flat half space with a boundary supported, say, at the location x perp equals 0, where x perp parameterizes the transverse distance to the boundary. And again, we'll ask that the boundary condition preserves half of the supercharges, and in particular, a 0-2 supersymmetry algebra on the boundary. And we'll also focus on boundary conditions that preserve the U1R symmetry of this algebra, which is also inherited from the bulk superalgebra. Now, everything in our analysis will be purely semi-classical. We'll study these boundary conditions very simply in a UV gauge theory description, where everything can be done completely precise. And hopefully, with this condition of preserving the U1R symmetry, one can hope that the boundary condition will then flow to a nice superconformal boundary condition in the IR. We can compute various indices, as we'll see, to check that this works out nicely. So the two supercharges that I'm preserving today, I'll just call Q plus and Q bar plus, which anti-commute to some translation in the plane of the boundary. Now, yesterday and in other talks in the workshop, we've already heard a lot about how to construct boundary conditions semi-classically when you have a nice gauge theory with a Lagrangian description. And so because this aspect of the analysis was essentially already reviewed so aptly, and the same kind of analysis carries through these three-dimensional theories with Lagrangian descriptions, I'll just be very brief and remind you that, as always, you know, we'll start with some basic boundary conditions that set, say, one either one of our fundamental variables u or v to 0, or the other, where u and v should be viewed of as your natural conjugate variables in a phase space akin to a position or momentum. And in the context of these supersymmetric boundary conditions, what we find, say for a single chiral multiplet in a 3D n equals 2 theory, is that the conjugate variables naturally take the form of basic 0-2 multiplets. So for any 3D n equals 2 bulk field that's organized in a multiplet, like a chiral or a vector, we can ask how this multiplet splits into representations of the 0-2 algebra that we're preserving on the boundary. And for example, a 3D n equals 2 chiral multiplet splits into two kinds of 0-2 multiplets. One is a chiral in the 0-2 sense, which I've labeled here by phi, and another is a Fermi multiplet called psi. And then the analog of the basic boundary conditions that we've seen earlier in the workshop, the Neumann or Dirichlet, or Dirichlet boundary conditions, set one of these multiplets or the other multiplet to 0. So this is manifestly supersymmetric. And indeed, if you expand these multiplets into components, you see that they're nothing but the 0-2 supersymmetric completions of the Neumann and Dirichlet boundary conditions. And more generally, you can add interesting deformations, boundary terms, localized at your boundary conditioner interface, and study more general boundary conditions arising from setting the variation of the boundary action to 0, as we've seen many, many times before. Now, this is a very general prescription, perturbatively, and you can get quite a lot out of it. And I'll stress that you can, in this framework, and indeed sometimes you must, couple to extra purely two-dimensional matter supported on the boundary condition or the interface. And those purely 2D, say Fermi or chiral multiplets or vector multiplets or whatever you like, also I'm denoting by gamma and C, and also can appear in the action localized at the boundary. And good. Now, why would you need to add purely two-dimensional matter? Of course, this is certainly an option, and it's perfectly consistent to do so. And if you add boundary interaction terms in manifestly 0-2 framework, you know, we're producing sort of for free nice supersymmetric boundary conditions. That's perfectly fine to do. But sometimes it's compulsory to add these extra two-dimensional fields in order to get a consistent boundary condition in the first place. And a famous example in three dimensions that I think many of you are familiar with is because one, in the presence of a boundary, will typically have gauge anomalies. And so you might wish to add some simple two-dimensional matter in order to cancel a gauge anomaly. And this happens in particular if one has a Neumann boundary condition on a gauge field in a three-dimensional Lagrangian description. In other words, you're preserving the gauge symmetry on the boundary, and so one typically has to add additional two-dimensional matter to cancel that anomaly. And in the presence of non-trivial interactions, and indeed 3D n equals 2 theories can have nice holomorphic superpotentials turned on so that the chiral multiplets talk to one another, there are sometimes circumstances where one will need to add two-dimensional matter to deal with issues related to the preservation of a supersymmetric vacuum. I won't go into the details today, but again, I discussed this a bit last year, and feel free to talk to me if you want more details about that case. Now, we're not just interested in constructing these semi-classical boundary conditions, although you can certainly have a lot of fun doing doing this construction as generally as you possibly can, but we'd also like to have dual pairs of boundary conditions in the sense that I described earlier in the talk. And if two boundary conditions are dual to one another, at least putatively, we have to ask that the flavor symmetries on the two sides coincide with one another, and we had also better match all of the Atuft anomalies. I won't go through the computation of these quantities, but you should keep in mind that these are necessary for any of our tentative proposals to go through. And indeed, sometimes matching these symmetries or anomalies can require the presence of additional two-dimensional matter as well. And we'll see that coming up in an example shortly. And finally, as I mentioned earlier, since we're in a nice supersymmetric situation, it behooves us to subject our proposals to further tests. And of course, our favorite test in the presence of supersymmetry is to compute some kind of index. And there's a very natural in this in the case of a bulk boundary coupled system. There's an index called the half index, which you can define either more in a path integral formulation or more operatorially, and I'll be operatorial today, that you can view as a trace over boundary local operators with a certain nice supersymmetric insertion in the trace. Here, X is just denoting a variable that's keeping track of any and all flavor symmetries or global symmetries that I have in the problem, and Q, as usual, is keeping track of some kind of supersymmetric combination of quantum numbers, in this case related to the R charge of the fields and their spin in the plane of the boundary. The details aren't important for today, but let me just stress that one can view the contributions to this half index as a count of local gauge invariant operators that are moreover in the cohomology of one of the supercharges preserved by the boundary. And I call this supercharge Q bar plus. And you can proceed by counting up these observables in a free theory limit, as one normally likes to do with these indices. And one gets these kind of very familiar free field type expressions, various products. So this pi n is the half index for just a free chiral multiplet with a Neumann boundary condition, which remember means that we're setting the Fermi multiplet part of the 3D chiral to 0, vice versa for this pi d, the Dirichlet boundary condition. And one should also compute the contribution from any purely two-dimensional matter that one adds. For example, a purely 2D Fermi multiplet gives an expression like this, which looks like a doubling of the degrees of freedom of the boundary condition of a 3D chiral. So a lot of this stuff looks familiar in the sense that you've probably seen very analogous things in other contexts. So let me give you an example of a dual pair of boundary condition that will be useful for the remainder of the talk. Then I'll use these dual boundary conditions in this example to construct a duality interface for a certain pair of theories. I'll also use that in the applications in the remainder of the talk. And then we'll move right on to the applications, just using this example as sort of our benchmark case for thinking about these quantities. Okay, so let's start with one of our favorite examples of infrared dual 3D n equals 2 quantum field theories. On one side, we have super QED. So we have a U1 vector multiplet, and we also have two chiral multiplets with opposite gauge charge, phi and phi tilde. And on the other side, the dual theory that we'll consider is called the XYZ model, which is a theory of just three chiral multiplets, no non-trivial gauge group, and they're coupled by some cubic superpotential W, W equals XYZ. And this duality has been known for a long time and subjected to many tests, originally studied in the work by Aharoni, Hanani, and Trilligator, Seiberg, and Strassler. And let me just tell you, for the purposes of today's talk, some of the basic elements of the duality dictionary. In particular, for one of the chiral multiplets on the XYZ side that I'll call Z, this is dual to the mesonic field by phi tilde. And on the other, we should also ask, okay, what are the duality counterparts of the other two chiral multiplets, X and Y? And it's been shown, tested in many works, that these other two chiral fields, X and Y, are dual to the basic monopole operators on the gauge theory side. So let's just keep those elements of the dictionary in mind for the sequel. So let me present a simple dual pair of boundary conditions in these two theories. So let's start with super QED. And it's often nice to start when one is thinking about boundary conditions with something like a boundary condition with all Dirichlet boundary conditions on all of the fields. So let me walk you through this a little bit. So let's start by requiring that we put Dirichlet boundary conditions on both of the fundamental chiral fields in SQED, phi and phi tilde. Well, okay, if we're setting phi and phi tilde to zero at the boundary, meaning the zero to chiral components of the 3D field, well then of course the mesonic operator also gets set to zero at the boundary. And on the dual side, well, I told you that the mesonic operator was dual to one of these chiral multiplets that I called Z. And therefore, I expect that the boundary condition on the dual side should also set z to 0 at the boundary, very naturally. So we'll put a Dirichlet boundary condition here. Now, I'll also impose Dirichlet boundary conditions on the vector multiplet of SQED. And the Dirichlet boundary condition is fairly interesting. It sets the parallel components of the gauge field to zero on the boundary. And one can show that this boundary condition, that the gauge transformations that preserve the Dirichlet boundary condition on the gauge field are precisely the constant gauge transformations. So a Dirichlet boundary condition actually supports not a G-gauge symmetry on the boundary, but rather a global G-symmetry. So with the Dirichlet boundary condition on the gauge field, we'll have an extra global symmetry in the problem to play with. And you can also show, and I won't go into the derivation of this, but it turns out that in the presence of a Dirichlet boundary condition on the gauge field, well, one is allowed to bring bulk monopole operators to the boundary, and they survive on the boundary. They're like a Neumann boundary condition on the monopoles, if you like. So if I put Dirichlet boundary conditions on my gauge field, then my two basic monopole operators from the previous slide, V plus and minus, are unconstrained on the boundary, and I have a U1 global symmetry. But if the monopoles are unconstrained, that suggests that their dual pairs, the Y and Z multiplets, should be unconstrained on their dual boundary, and therefore I expect to put Neumann boundary conditions on Y and Z. OK, Okay, that sounds pretty reasonable. But so far, there's a mismatch of global symmetries. In particular, there's nothing on this side so far that matches the U1 global symmetry that's inherited from the Dirichlet boundary condition on the gauge field. And furthermore, you can compute the Yatufte anomalies in this theory and check the mismatch between the two sides, and you'll find that what you need to compensate for the mismatch of the symmetries and the anomalies can be perfectly compensated by just an extra 2D Fermi multiplet called gamma, which of course, if it's just a free Fermi multiplet, enjoys a U1 rotation symmetry and compensates perfectly. So there's an extra Fermi multiplet on the dual side that we need, and its role in life is to make up this mismatch. And now everything works perfectly, and you can compute this half index, for example, and you get some very forbidding looking expressions, but you can actually prove that they're equivalent, and things match nicely, and we seem to be in business. Now, given a nice dual pair of boundary conditions, you can often do something further with them and construct a duality interface. The cartoon goes as follows, and I'd like to use my dual boundary conditions to construct a duality interface for SQED and XYZ. And the picture, which unfortunately I'll have to go through a little bit quickly, is the following. So I'll be rather schematic, but we'll have our explicit duality interface on the next slide. So the methodology is to start with some theory T. Let's keep in mind SQED. And the idea is to take the theory on a full space and split it up by endowing it with a left and right boundary condition that I call B and B shriek. And I'm choosing boundary conditions such that I can recouple them together and have them flow to the identity interface in the infrared. So for example, a Neumann boundary condition and a Dirichlet boundary condition would be a nice pair of boundary conditions that can easily be glued together and sort of recover the identity interface. So it's like doing nothing on the one hand. But on the other hand, if I split the theory like this, and then imagine dualizing half of the theory on the half space to the theory T check and the dual boundary condition B check, then I can attempt to recouple these two halves together via the boundary conditions B check and B shriek in such a way that's consistent with, again, preserving all the symmetries of the problem and the various consistency conditions that I'm mostly suppressing today, and obtain a duality interface. And the hope is that if this procedure commutes, then this will exactly be a duality interface because it will have, again, the defining property that it flows once again to the trivial interface in the infrared. So, for example, as we going back to our test case on the previous slide, let's start with SQED. We have an all Dirichlet boundary condition B on one side. I know how to dualize that to XYZ with that DNN plus gamma boundary condition shorthand. And on the other side, T, I'll have all Neumann boundary condition, which again, it's easy to check, proves is kind of the thing you need to have this property. And then we try to just couple these things together as generally as we possibly can while respecting the symmetries and see what we get. And I claim, though I'm again being short on details, though you can subject this to many, many checks, that a duality interface can be constructed in exactly this way with XYZ on one side, SQED on the other side. So here is the shorthand just denoting the boundary conditions on the bulk fields as they approach the interface. This gamma sandwiched in the middle is the shorthand for my Fermi multiplet that came from the dual boundary side. And you can ask what kinds of interactions can I possibly turn on. You can play with it a little bit. And it turns out that in this case, it seems like there's really, or in fact, there is only one option consistent with all the symmetries and consistency conditions of the problem. So there's an explicit interface superpotential that's given by a sum of a few manifestly 0-2 supersymmetric terms. And if you like 0-2 supersymmetry, you're familiar with it, you know that these are called J and E terms. If you don't, you can ignore the fact that they appear a little bit asymmetrically and look a little funny and just view them as supersymmetrizations of Yukawa couplings. And if you expand it in components, indeed, that's exactly what you see. We'll have a Fermi and two chiral coupling on each of these terms. For example, the 2D Fermi multiplet gamma is on the one side coupled to phi, one of our chirals from SQED, and on the other side coupled to another chiral x. And playing with this a little bit further, you can look at the variation of the action and study the terms that arise from the interface, and you get nice results, like the presence of this term here, which is the Fermi multiplet associated to Z coupled to the meson, reproduces at the interface the identification arising from the duality that our chiral Z is dual to the mesonic operator phi phi tilde. You can further study quantum corrections to this superpotential and recover the map of the monopoles with the other chirals. So this duality seems to have the nice property that indeed it's mediating the duality transformation across the interface. And all looks well. So this duality interface, yeah.
Wow. Is it guaranteed that it's always possible, and how does it work, this gluing back of the boundary condition that you were doing in the previous slides?
Yeah.
There's a general procedure valid for any CFP?
In all the examples studied in the paper, I can at least say that it seems to work readily, and in fact, it seems that the only interactions we were able to turn on were exactly the interactions sort of consistent with the symmetries of the problem and consistent with other conditions like factorization and things that I didn't tell you about. So in all the cases we've studied, it not only seems to work, but also the simplest possible option seems to mediate the duality correctly. I can think about it a little bit about a more general argument, but I can at least say that so far everything we've done works. Good. So that set the stage. We'll keep the boundary conditions, and in particular the duality interface for SQED and XYZ in mind for the rest of the talk. Now I'd like to move on and tell you as much about applications of these things as I can. So the first application will be of a more geometric flavor. And it involves the various geometric and field theoretic correspondences that arise from everyone's favorite object in M-theory, potentially, the M5 brain. And what do we do when you're out in the wild and you're taking a walk and someone hands you an M5 brain and asks you what you'd like to do with the M5 brain? Well, if you're a person of a certain disposition, perhaps like myself, you might wish to take this 5-brain and compactify it on manifolds of various dimensionality and see what you get, and perhaps also recover or derive some interesting statements about the resulting geometry of the compactification manifold. And this is a huge story with a rich history, and unfortunately I have to, again, be brief through the lore here. But recall that the world volume theory of the M5 brain is a 6220 superconformal field theory labeled by an A to Ely algebra G at low energies. For me today, G is always SL2, so you can just imagine the world volume theory arising from a stack of just two M5 brains, so we'll restrict to that for simplicity today. And then you can take this theory and compactify it, say, on a D-dimensional manifold and obtain a theory called T of MD. Where the theory is supported in 6 minus d dimensions, but in principle, when you're doing a KK reduction on MD, the theory can have various effective couplings that depend on the details of the geometry of the D manifold. So it's labeled in some sense by MD. And a little bit more precisely, what we'd like to do is think about the superconformal or the D by R of this resulting T of MD theory. And the expectation, which is borne out by various arguments and calculations, is that at least in the deep IR, many details of the metric and the details of the geometry that would potentially appear in the effective couplings of the field theory at high energies will wash away or uniformize, if you like, at low energies. And so the expectation is that the IR fixed point will be sensitive roughly only to the topology of the manifold rather than the various details of the geometry. So in some sense, we're getting field theories labeled by geometric data, but we'd like to think about the fixed points where we're really thinking about some kind of topological invariance of the resulting manifold. And of course, one can turn this around and try to generate interesting dualities of field theories labeled by the geometry. And there's a whole story that also gives one interesting correspondences when one is considering the theory on product manifolds, changing the order of compactification and producing protected quantities. But I won't go into the details of the correspondence today. So let's just think about compactifying the 6D theory on interesting manifolds and studying the resulting T of MD. And we'll see soon that for me, I'll be interested in 3- and 4-dimensional manifolds. And I'll explain how duality interfaces have anything to say about this story at all. So the philosophy that we took in our work that appeared earlier this year is the following. If the gauge group that we're interested in is just U1, or we're considering the theory of a single M5 brain, well, then we just have an abelian-free tensor theory. We can do the compactification or the KK reduction quite explicitly, and we can study this theory in detail. But as we know more generally, when the gauge group is non-abelian, this is some very difficult theory to get a handle on. It's strongly interacting, and I lack many of the explicit tools that I usually have in order to study these things. So how can one make progress, particularly as the dimension of the compactification manifold increases and the problem becomes harder and harder? Well, one can try to take a more bottom-up approach. Start with some field theories that you know and love with Lagrangian descriptions that you can study explicitly. Try to associate simple such field theories to pieces of manifolds. Today I'll be focusing on basic triangulated building blocks or simplices. And then try to formulate field theoretic gluing rules on the one hand to build up an interesting theory associated to our glued up D manifold on the other hand. Try to bootstrap up an interesting theory and then argue that hopefully, if all goes well, it flows to the same interesting superconformal fixed point as the T of MD that you're interested in the first place. And this triangulation style program, where one is associating simple Lagrangian field theories to just pieces of D manifolds, has been carried out in most detail in three dimensions. Today I'll tell you about an extension a little bit in four dimensions. In general, one finds that this prescription associates nice abelian gauge theories with n equals 2 supersymmetry to three-dimensional manifolds. And we'll see what happens in four dimensions. But I should stress that there are many difficulties and subtleties with this approach. And in particular, in three dimensions, one finds that rather than landing on the full, say, T of M3 using this approach, one gets instead a subsector. I won't go through the arguments of this, but just that there are various technical caveats to keep in mind. But nonetheless, okay, we have some very concrete approach where we can compute everything in sight, and nonetheless, we're able to recover a rich and interesting interacting subsector of the theory we're interested in the first place. So let's go with that and see what we can do. We're not the first people to study four manifolds, in particular with the M5 brain theory in mind, and there's a lot of interesting work on smooth structures. And so this triangulation sort of bottom-up approach is complementary to a lot of other interesting existing work that I don't have time to tell you about. So let's see. In view of time, let me give you the upshot of what we've done, and I'll go through the details as expediently as possible, because I'd like to also get to the physics application before my time runs out. So here's the upshot for the role of duality interfaces in the study of the geometry of four manifolds. So, okay, we have some d-dimensional manifold. We want to study T of MD, and I argued that in the deep IR, only the topology of the manifold matters. So if we're constructing some kind of UV Lagrangian description of this theory that in principle depends on the details of the geometry or on the way we're presenting the geometry, and in particular if I'm doing something that manifestly depends on the triangulation, then a basic aspect of this dictionary had better be that if I have two, say, three manifolds that are the same underlying three-manifold topologically, but differ by a change in triangulation, my prescription had better produce two 3D field theories for me that are infrared dual to one another. Otherwise, this proposal just doesn't seem like it has any legs at all. Again, this has been studied already by Domofte, Gyoto, and Gukov in three dimensions, and their triangulation invariance for three manifolds is indeed shown to give us infrared dualities in the transverse three-dimensional field theory. Okay, so far, so good. So what's new here? Well, geometrically, you can ask what kind of geometric objects mediates a change in translation between two three-manifolds. And indeed, there's a four-dimensional cobordism between two triangulated three-manifolds that implements a basic change in triangulation of the underlying manifold. This object is exactly the simplest possible triangulated four-manifold, called a four-simplex. So geometrically, this four-simplex is mediating a 3D change in triangulation. What does this have to do with the field theory side? Well, if I'm compactifying the M5 brain on manifolds, say with boundaries, then all of these correspondences have to work nicely, they have to play nicely with one another. So in particular, if I have a 4-manifold with a boundary that's 2 3-manifolds, then field theoretically, I should be able to construct a setup where I have my 2 IR dual 3D field theories corresponding to the boundaries, and there should be a field theoretic mediator of the IR duality, and that's exactly the duality interface that we've already talked about, and we know how to construct it. Great. So essentially, I've already told you what a field theoretic object one associates to the simplest triangulated 4-manifold. It's the duality interface that we constructed before. In fact, as I'll explain, it's exactly the duality interface that I constructed before. But now I'd like to bootstrap my way up, if you'll pardon me overloading the term bootstrap, to study the geometry of more intricate 4-dimensional manifolds using this technology. So I'd like to develop some gluing rules. And again, if I'm studying a triangulated 4-manifold, well, just as in the 3-dimensional case, I had better make sure I get an infrared duality if I'm just studying 2 4-manifolds that differ by a change in triangulation. These basic triangulation changing operations in any dimensions are called Pochner moves. And in this case, it turns out what I need is infrared duality of these 2-dimensional duality interfaces. What we do is we study 2-dimensional duality interfaces associated to different triangulations of common 4-manifolds. We show indeed that they're infrared dual to one another. And the way that the duality works at the level of the interfaces is very interesting. It turns out that these 4D Pochner moves employ dualities of 2D02 theories in various interesting ways and combinations. And we recover some nice abelian dualities that have also been previously discovered in the literature by Gade, Gukov, and Putrov. For example, we recover some basic dualities of, say, 2 free Fermi multiplets with 0-2 supersymmetry on the one hand, and on the other hand, a 2D1 gauge theory with some matter content and various superpotentials. So our interfaces seem to already know about some nice abelian dualities that people have studied before. So let me give you a little bit more of a flavor for this in the time remaining, and just explain the geometric setup and give you a little bit more details of the field theory construction. So again, here's the picture. We have a 4-manifold, the boundary is 2 3-manifolds, and I'll focus for now on 3 manifolds that are topologically equivalent, but differ by a change in triangulation. And if I put the M5 brain on this object, I'll hopefully obtain exactly the a duality interface of the type that we constructed earlier. Great. So here's a little bit of geometry, just for fun. If we want to build up triangulated manifolds or piecewise linear manifolds, then the basic object in D dimensions is a D simplex, which is some kind of in fact, the simplest convex regular polytope that has D plus 1 vertices. So in 2 dimensions, a 2-simplex is triangle. It's literally a triangle, hence triangulations. And more generally, in 3 dimensions, we have a tetrahedron, which flattened on the plane looks like this, which you all are familiar with. And in 4 dimensions, one gets an object called the 4-simplex, or sometimes called a pentachoron. Here it is projected onto 2 dimensions, so named because it has 5 vertices. And you can glue any triangulated manifold together using these D simplices by gluing them along various faces and edges. And as I already mentioned briefly, any 2 homeomorphic manifolds that are piecewise linear, or PL, are known to be related by a finite sequence of moves called Pochner moves. So in D dimensions, there's a very small number of D-dimensional Pochner moves, and any 2 homeomorphic manifolds, topologically the same manifold with different triangulations, can be related by just a finite sequence of these very elementary moves. So in 2 dimensions, here are the only 2 Pochner moves. They're called a 1-3 and a 2-2 move. Again, the naming is sort of clear. It takes a single triangle to this group of 3 triangles, and the 2-2 move just flips a square along an edge like that. And there are various moves also in 3 dimensions. Here's the 1-4 move, a 2-3 move. Again, they're just named by how many D simplices go to how many other D simplices. But what I just want you to notice in 2 dimensions, because it's easy to visualize, is that the 2 2-dimensional Pochner moves, this 1-3 and 2-2 moves, can actually and be viewed in an interesting way. Namely, this triangle and this triangle look exactly like the two top and bottom triangles of the tetrahedron, the three simplex, if I view it from the top or the bottom. Similarly, if I rotate it a little bit, the two two moves look like the triangulation of the two other boundaries of the tetrahedron, the ones that are split up into two squares. And indeed, this is completely general. The D plus one simplex is the basic operation for going between triangulations of D manifolds. It generates all the D-dimensional Pockner moves for you, and so it's the instrument of changing triangulations. And the different Pockner moves are always different ways to divide the boundary of that D plus one simplex in half, and you could get them all that way, which is kind of cute. And so in 3D, the 2-3 move has been studied in the context of this triangulation approach to the M5 brain theory that I mentioned. And in 4D, we want to reproduce triangulation invariance, in particular, for the four-dimensional Pockner moves. So if we start in D equals 3, so we'd like these to eventually be boundary theories for our four manifolds, then the 6D theory on some three manifold with some dependence on the presentation of the triangulation will produce for us a 3D n equals 2 theory. This is worked out in a prescription by Dymov, Degayeto, and Gukov. Unfortunately, today I'll mostly just have to black box it for us. And again, an IR duality of corresponding field theories indeed arises when the manifolds are disrelated by a change in triangulation. For instance, the manifolds associated to these so-called bipyramids. So here's the 2-3 move again. It's two different ways to triangulate the bipyramid, one into two tetrahedra, 2-3 simplices, and one into three tetrahedra, or 3-3 simplices. And remember, the four simplex geometrically mediates this 2-3 move for us. And field theoretically, the DGG prescription, in fact, associates to this basic bipyramid exactly our two familiar theories from earlier in the talk. Very, very roughly speaking, to each tetrahedron, you should imagine there's a chiral multiplet, and then the various kinds of gluings that one can do should be viewed either as potentially gauging some of the flavor symmetries of the chiral multiplets, or perhaps coupling them together by a superpotential. Let's black box most of the dictionary for now, but here you see, you know, two pieces, two chiral multiplets, and indeed, more precisely, you really get NF equals one SQED on one side, and on the other side, you get exactly the XYZ model. We know they're IR dual to one another, and so this is a nice check of the prescription in three dimensions. And moreover, since the four simplex is mediating this change of triangulation, again, we know exactly what field theoretic object to associate to the four simplex based on this prescription. It's the duality interface between SQED and XYZ, and we've built it earlier in the talk. And you can subject it to various tests to see geometric symmetries, say, arising on the field theory side to give you confidence that this is really sort of the right object to associate to this simple triangulated geometry. Now, in view of time, I won't go through many of the details of how we prove triangulation invariance. But remember, in Pockner moves and D dimensions are mediated by D plus one simplices, so you might think that I have to know something about the five simplex if I want to prove facts about the 4D Pockner moves, because I'd like to build up four manifolds and theories associated to them that are triangulation invariant. Five simplex is a bit above my pay grade, but there is another way to think about changes of triangulations in D dimensions, and it turns out that there is a nice geometric way to do this as sequences of D minus one dimensional Pockner moves. So here's the 2-3 move viewed as two sequences of 2-2 moves. And if you go through the geometry, you see that this is exactly another way to represent the 2-3 move between those two bipyramids, just in terms of basic elementary steps. Great. And we worked out a similar geometric sequence for the various four-dimensional Pockner moves that we were interested in. Here's the 3-3 move in a sequence of three steps on each side, 3 and 3, between, in this case, triangulated octahedra, certain three-dimensional manifolds. Okay, so we've realized our Pockner moves as sequences of lower-dimensional moves. To each of these manifolds, by the DGG prescription, we have a 3D n equals 2 quantum field theory. By construction, they're infrared dual to one another, and I can construct duality interfaces at each step of these sequences on both the top and the bottom, and get a field theoretic configuration like this. Sequences of 3D theories related by sequences of duality interfaces. And they had better be IR equivalent if our prescription works. So we can collide these interfaces together and get some composite interfaces, and indeed check the infrared duality of these kinds of sequences. This is the obligatory, horrible slide that no one is expected to pay attention to or care about, but is just to reassure and comfort the audience that indeed there are many non-trivial calculations supporting all of this that bear out the pictures that I'm drawing on the slides for you. There's a lot of superpotentials to keep track of, there's many background Chern-Simons levels and charges, and one has to pay detailed attention to all these things to prove that indeed the top and bottom duality interfaces from my two sequences are IR equivalent, but indeed they are. And it's very explicit. It looks a little messy on the slide, but it's quite systematic, and so it gives us an interesting handle on four-dimensional geometry, which is generally pretty difficult to get a handle on. And you can further probe the duality by colliding these interfaces on both the top and the bottom with boundary conditions on one side or both sides, and further see if you get interesting dualities of these theories on half spaces or strips, and compute associated indices, and check the duality further that way. And indeed, that all works out as well. Now, I'm already out of time, so let me just say a word about some work in progress and invite you to ask questions about it after the talk. So given the construction of dual boundary conditions, there's another nice thing that one can imagine doing, which is to take two dual 3D theories, T and T check, sandwich, say, T by left and right boundary conditions B1 and B2, and then sandwich the dual theory by the dual boundary conditions B1 check and B2 check, and then try to collide them. The collision is itself an RG flow, or a partial integrating out of degrees of freedom in this transverse direction. But the hope is that if this is a commutative diagram, once again, then one can produce two-dimensional theories, T2D and T2D check, that are dual to one another. And this can be made most precise in the context of a supersymmetric theory, where one does a suitable twist to render this transverse direction topological, so the collision process can be carried out, essentially, without penalty. And then you can check the equalities of, or check the dualities of the putative 2D theories with 2D elliptic genera. So this is a nice way to either reproduce existing 2D dualities or generate new ones. And so we've started to do this. Again, since I'm out of time, I won't say too much about it. But there turns out to be a very interesting mechanism that gets the collision process to work out and to recover all the 2D degrees of freedom that you might expect from 3D theories with boundary conditions, related to the topological descent formalism that was introduced by Witten in his study of Donaldson theory. So I just invite you to ask me questions after that, after the talk, if you're interested. And indeed, we find some interesting new physics related to the collision of boundary conditions, even in some very basic sandwiches of 3D theories that we know and love, such as the 3D chiral and U1 gauge theory plus a chiral. So I think there's a lot of fun stuff to do, and also this is very much work in progress. Some of the calculations for this I was doing last night, but unfortunately the workshop was so engaging that I didn't have time to finish it. So although I'm thanking the organizers, I'm also blaming the organizers for making things too interesting, and I didn't get to finish as much as I wanted to do. But I think there's some very cute stuff. And I'm out of time, so I'll just put the conclusion slide up and end it there.
Okay, thank you, Natalie. Are there questions? Okay, well, if not, then let me ask one. So you seem to have made a lot of use of commuting diagrams, commuting the RG flow with the action of duality interfaces.
Yeah.
Do we expect that commutativity to still hold, say, when you have emergence of accidental?
Great question. So as I mentioned, the commutativity is sort of most justifiable in the context of a twist that renders the transverse direction to the boundaries to the boundary conditions topological, particularly or most precisely when one is working in the cohomology of a supercharge, and so that works really great. Perhaps all I should say is that with my colleague Poshen at Caltech, we're trying to see to what extent we can reproduce some interesting non-supersymmetric dualities with this method. I'll say that there are some preliminary cases that seem to work well, but there's of course quite a lot that is that requires some hand waving, that requires more careful arguments. As you might expect, in the absence of supersymmetry, anything that you can generate upon a collision, you probably will, and it can get tricky.
Okay, so any other questions? Okay, just remember, if you're in room 611 at the Delta Hotel, I have your key, so please come see me at the break. Okay, let's thank Natalie again. Thanks.